Many may have read earlier this month that years of legal wrangling about a sulfalane contamination coming from the North Pole refinery resulted in a multi-million dollar judgment against former owner Williams Alaska Petroleum. What many may not know is that research led by University of Alaska Fairbanks microbiologist Mary Beth Lee played a role in the trial. Lee and her team looked at possible bioremediation of a miles-long plume of sulfalane that has contaminated groundwater in North Pole. I talked with Lee about her research and what it was like to testify at the trial.
Well, I have to admit it was a little scary, having not done it before, you know, realizing the importance of this case. Then I really, you know, took care to review everything that I had done, all the research that I and my collaborators and students had done to make sure I could represent it accurately, and did my best to prepare to answer whatever questions they might have for me. But then it was, you know, exciting to see that our work was taking the stage and would be relevant to this case and to helping the courts decide what was fair to do.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine one side would be more favorably inclined, whoever asked you to testify, and then the other side would be a little more adversarial.
Yeah, well, certainly I was a witness for the state, and so the trial opened with direct examination, which is the state's legal counsel asking questions, and questions that I more or less anticipated that they would ask, just as a way to facilitate the process of my explaining our research and our outcomes. And then being cross-examined was the part, of course, that I was a little bit more apprehensive about, and that was the situation in which Williams's attorneys were examining and cross-examining and asking some follow-up questions. So that was an unusual experience for me. I think the closest parallel might have been my PhD defense or a comprehensive exam for anyone who's been in graduate school. Felt a little bit like that, you know, having your research challenged and just having to, you know, make sure that you're able to justify the experiments that you did and the conclusions that you drew. And in the end, I really had no problem doing that.
Well, then let's back off then and talk about that research. As I understand, you and your colleagues sampled, took cores of this plume of sulfalane that is tied to the petroleum refinery out in North Pole. Is that right?
That's right. And our goal was to try to understand whether there was some potential for that sulfalane to biodegrade naturally in the subsurface. So we took core samples, or they were actually collected by environmental consultants that were hired by the refinery to do routine sorts of monitoring and assessment of the site. And they provided us with those samples, and we took them into the lab here at UAF. And we did a series of experiments to try to understand whether there were microbes naturally present there that were capable of biodegrading or essentially eating that sulfalane that was present. And then once we found that there were microbes that could do that, we did a series of follow-up tests to try to identify them and to understand the processes that they used for doing that, and to ultimately try to understand what might be limiting their activity in the environment.
I know research isn't cheap. How did you get your funding for this?
Well, the primary funding for this study came from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. When this issue became clear to them, they really felt that they needed to have some objective third-party research done to fully understand the potential fate of the sulfalane in the groundwater, whether it would biodegrade on its own, what the path of the plume would be, whether there might be ways to help remediate it, things like that. So DEC approached me and my collaborator, David Barnes, here at UAF in the Institute of Northern Engineering, and together we took on this project with funding from the state as well as from Alaska INBRI, which is a National Institutes of Health funded program that's administered by UAF, and they help support one of the graduate students that worked on the project, as well as providing some of the great equipment that we were able to use in the lab.
For a layperson like myself, I think, okay, when you take these samples, there must be thousands of different microbes in any given sample. Mm-hmm. How do you tease them out once you identify one that seems to be successfully taking up sulfalane and processing it?
Yeah, we used an exciting method that's just come out in the past decade or two that makes use of isotopes to try to track the food sources that certain microbes use and to identify them. In this case, we used what's known as stable isotope probing, and we provided sulfalane in a special form. So sulfalane is made up of carbon and sulfur, and some oxygen. And this particular form of sulfalane had special carbon atoms in it, and those carbon atoms were called C13. They have a little, they have an extra neutron in their nucleus, and so they're a little bit heavier than normal carbon. They're not radioactive, they're just heavier. And we provided that special sulfalane to this mixture of essentially soil from core samples and groundwater, and we incubated it in the lab and watched as the microbes ate that sulfalane. And then we were able to track that isotope, that special C13, into the DNA of just the microbes that ate the sulfalane. And then by analyzing just the DNA of those organisms, we could identify them.
What led you to think that there would be microbes that would be useful this way?
We always start our research by looking into the scientific literature, and we found that as far back as the 1970s, there were reports of people using microbes in industrial wastewater treatment plant scenarios to try to lower the levels of sulfalane that were present. And there were a lot of great studies that came out of Western Canada in the 1990s and early 2000s that showed sulfalane biodegrading microorganisms in groundwater at a contaminated site. And so we were able to build upon those studies and use some of their same methods to explore what might be happening in the North Pole aquifer.
Which bacterium did it turn out that was useful for this process?
Well, we found that in the North Pole aquifer, there was really only one bacterium that was active in degrading sulfalane, and it's a member of the genus called Rhodopherax. It's closely related to a species called Rhodopherax ferrireducens, which is a microbe that's known to occur pretty broadly in the environment, and it's able to use iron in some cases instead of oxygen. But our particular organism seemed not to be able to use iron instead of oxygen to break down sulfalane. We found that it was only active in the presence of oxygen.
Help me here when you say oxygen. Does that mean that it had to be exposed to the air in order for it to start eating?
Yeah, essentially, much like our cells, many biological organisms need oxygen to complete their metabolism. And so in the case of the microbes from North Pole that could degrade sulfalane, we found that they could only do it when they had oxygen. And we provided that oxygen just by creating a swirling flask sort of experiment. So, you know, the microbes are present in the groundwater and in the soil from the core sample that we have in the flask. We have the top covered so that other microbes don't contaminate it, but there's enough permeability in the cover that oxygen can get through. And then when we put that on a shaker, that keeps it swirling, then the oxygen mixes into the water, dissolves into the water. And groundwater does have, you know, in some cases, a little bit of oxygen dissolved in it. So we were trying to simulate a very high oxygen scenario.
More than groundwater would naturally occur,
yeah,
right?
Okay. Right. So we were kind of exploring the highly oxygenated end of things, and that's much more than is actually present in the aquifer. We also did similar kinds of experiments, but in the absence of oxygen, which is much more representative of the actual subsurface, where there's low levels, but there can be zero to extremely low levels that are below what microbes can use. And we found that there was no sulfalane degradation when we didn't provide oxygen. Hmm. And this goes a long way towards explaining the size of the sulfalane plume in North Pole. We found that there are microbes that are present that can break down the sulfalane, but only when oxygen is present. And there's very little oxygen in that groundwater, as is typical for groundwater. And so this could explain why the contaminated groundwater extends 3.5 miles from the source, because there's no appreciable biodegradation happening. We can't say that there's none ever happening, because there are a few places where there's a little bit more oxygen, but certainly there's not appreciable degradation that would cause that plume to shrink.
Does temperature play a role in this as well?
It might. You know, we didn't explore that a great deal because we were trying to replicate the environment. And so we ran all of our tests at relevant temperatures, which is about 4 to 7 degrees centigrade. Temperatures, yeah, that you would find in a permafrost aquifer.
Could this technique be applied by some engineering processes?
It could, and actually it was on a smaller scale in the refinery. It's not widely known, but in the Flint Hills refinery, there was a pilot scale system implemented that injected oxygen into the groundwater, and that technology is known as air sparging. And it is commonly used to help bioremediate petroleum spills, for example, and other kinds of chemical spills in the subsurface where oxygen is needed for the microbes to break it down. And so there was a period of time when the refinery was running this small-scale experimental system, and what they found is that the sulfalane did fairly rapidly disappear when they injected oxygen. And that supported our conclusions from what we found in the lab, that when we add oxygen, the sulfalane does biodegrade. But of course, air sparging is a technology that's fairly expensive to implement, and it's not good for extremely large areas because it's challenging to really get even distribution of oxygen. You can imagine you're injecting air bubbles into a highly compacted subsurface where there's, you know, silt and clay and sand. And so it would require a lot of different oxygen injection wells very close together to really fully aerate quite a large plume like this. So it's ultimately very impractical for the entire city of North Pole for this 3.5 by 2 to 2.5 mile wide plume to be remediated that way. Nonetheless, it's still exciting because in the future, if someone realizes they have a sulfalane problem, they could implement something like air sparging if they catch it early, and they might be able to contain that contaminant and help it to biodegrade before it travels as far as it has in this case.
I often think that it might be possible for this bacterium to be modified in such a way as to be more energetic or active in lower oxygen environments. Would that be something practical?
It is something that sometimes is done, is to genetically modify microorganisms to perform certain functions. And in the case of this organism, nobody has known before how sulfalane was biodegraded, so what genes are involved and what kinds of metabolic pathways microbes use. And we were able to use some DNA analysis to get some insight into how we think that process proceeds in this Rotifarax. And based on that information, one could, in theory, take those genes and transfer them to another organism, or maybe modify this organism so that it can function without oxygen. I think that would be a long way down the road, but it's possible that it could be done. One of the additional challenges, though, with environmental bioremediation like this is to be able to actually effectively release a high enough number of microorganisms from the lab to have them succeed in the environment and make a difference, because we would be talking about billions and billions of microbes over a very large area. But I think that something like that could be done, particularly in a smaller scale environment, like a wastewater treatment plant or a pump and treat system, maybe where one is trying to treat a more concentrated source of sulfalane, for instance.
You know, you said earlier in our discussion that there's this new technique using isotopes. And mm-hmm. Are we just at the cusp of developing the potential of microorganisms in bioremediation? Where does the field lie right now?
Well, it has a long history going back to things like oil spills and things like the Exxon Valdez, where there were a lot of discoveries made about the potential for microbes to biodegrade contaminants. And often the challenge that we face with bioremediation is trying to understand what it is that the microbes need to do their job better. In the case of the Exxon Valdez, they needed nutrients. They were running out of nitrogen, and so we added that, and they were able to be more effective. And I think that continues to be the challenge today, is to understand, of course, whether there are some microbes present that can break down chemicals, and then to find out what it is that they need to help them work more effectively. And in the case of a contaminant that's less well understood, like sulfalane, it's the biodegradation of sulfalane is not as well understood as something like petroleum that we've been studying for much longer, then we do need to make these fundamental discoveries of whether there are microbes out in the environment that can break it down in any particular environment, because it may not be everywhere. And then what is they really need? So in this case, we found they need oxygen. They had sufficient nutrients. We did examine that in the North Pole aquifer, and there's enough there for them to do what they need to do, but they really do need oxygen.
Mm. So what will be the follow-on? Do you think, will you get more research funding to continue this study or similar studies, do you think?
Well, I think that this particular study in North Pole has wrapped
up. Run its course, yeah.
Yeah, it has, and I'm happy to see that the results were, you know, found to be useful, that I think the state now has a good understanding of how long this contaminated plume is going to be around and whether it'll disappear on its own due to biodegradation. The evidence suggests that it won't biodegrade naturally, but it may, of course, eventually dissipate just through things like dilution over time. But I have occasionally gotten inquiries already about other sulfalane contaminated sites elsewhere, because sulfalane is what we consider an emerging contaminant. It's something that it's not yet very well studied, but people are discovering more and more that they do have sulfalane problems. And so now they're looking for answers like these. And so I'm hopeful that our work will help people around the country and around the world who have a similar issue.
And there are always more court cases to look forward to, right?
Let's hope not.
Yeah, really. Mary Beth Lee, University of Alaska Fairbanks, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Robert.